Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, and welcome to the Ghibliotech, the podcast that ambles through the archive of films from the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader, and I've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I've seen a couple of them.
So join us in our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. So Film 4, the film TV channel here in the UK, are doing a full Studio Ghibli retrospective this summer. And I do all things digital and online for them. And I'm a big Studio Ghibli fan. And I'm a podcaster on the side for Little White Lies Film Magazine. So I thought, what better way to combine all my passions into one and force a fellow podcaster, an esteemed colleague, to watch some of my favourite movies. That's you, Jake.
It is, yes. So I also host a podcast for the Curzon Cinema chain here in the UK and work in commissioning for Channel 4's shorts programme, Randomax. And so I spend a lot of my time working amongst films and either getting involved in making them or watching a lot of them for the show. But I really have never seen many Studio Ghiblis. Mm-hmm. This week we're watching Grave of the Fireflies.
Yes.
And that's only the third one I've seen.
The third one you've seen, I think the first one not directed by Hayao Miyazaki, who made Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke and My Neighbor Totoro, some of the big hitters of the Ghibli canon. This is Isao Takahata's film. He was the other director who co-founded the studio in the mid-80s, has a whole legacy of influence of his own.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and quite sadly, he passed away earlier this year, but this is, you know, a great opportunity to revisit his masterpiece.
Yeah, definitely. And in this series, we'll be looking at a number of different Ghibli films, and we'll be looking at their history and release, as well as talking through my first reactions to them as well.
So it's a great opportunity to get to grips with Ghibli, and with Grave of the Fireflies, if you want to pause right now, go and watch the film. We'll still be here when you come back, but otherwise we're going to plough through, and be warned, there'll be spoilers from the very off.
So here we go. Grave of the Fireflies.
Shortly after the end of the Second World War, a young boy dies of starvation in a train station. In flashback, we are introduced to Seita and his little sister Setsuko, who are left homeless after their house is destroyed in the firebombing raids on Kobe. Their mother is fatally wounded in the attack, and their father is serving in the Imperial Navy, so they must fight for their survival alone. They move in with nasty relatives, they trade family belongings for food, and finally they find a place for themselves in an abandoned bomb shelter. But their youthful spirit can only take them so far, as harsh reality inevitably takes its toll.
Yeah, this sounds like a really personal film, and I think it's a bit different to Spirited Away, to say the least.
It's so a heartbreaker.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see or to hear from you a bit more about this history. So we mentioned that this is the first non-Miyazaki film that I've seen. This is the first Takahata, and it is those two who kind of head up this studio. I don't really know much about him.
Sure, so Isao Takahata, as we said, one of the two filmmakers that set up Studio Ghibli in the mid-80s. He's actually a few years older than Hayao Miyazaki, and early on in his career was more of a mentor to Hayao Miyazaki. He has a whole career in his own right, very influential one, directing feature films, but also television series. There's a certain generation of Japanese animators who talk about Heidi Girl of the Alps and Anne of Green Gables as hugely influential, two series that have never made it to the UK officially, so I have no idea if they're any good. What's key about Issa Takahata in comparison to Hayao Miyazaki is that he's not an artist or an animator. He's purely a director and a writer. He actually studied French literature at Tokyo University, he's more of a storyteller. And that might seem to explain why his films that he made with the studio vary in style. He can be much more free and experimental, and it's more defined by the animators and the designers that he works with. He was something of a mythic figure at Studio Ghibli, right. Quite reclusive, worked very slowly.
Yes, because there's a lot more, even though from my brief reading of the filmography of Ghibli, I see Miyazaki's name appear a lot more often.
He only made 5 films before he passed away for Studio Ghibli, and this was the first one. He got the reputation at Ghibli as being descended from a giant sloth, because he worked very much at his own pace. And he also had a nickname from Miyazaki, which was Paku-san, which literally means Mr. Munch. And it comes from the fact that he would always sleep in and rush into work literally with his slice of toast in his mouth as he was walking into the office. So no time to sit down and eat.
This is off topic, but is Mr. Munch Paku-san? That's where Pac-Man comes
from. It is indeed,
actually. Close on his mouth.
Yeah, it's the same sort of onomatopoeic noise. But that's a bit on Takahata. Let's take us back to the
mid-late 80s. Where did this come from? Because this is an adaptation?
It's an adaptation of a novella that was written 20 years beforehand by Akiyuki Nosaka that's semi-autobiographical about his experiences in these firebombings at the end of the Second World War. And to place this in context with the mid-80s, Studio Ghibli had only just recently been founded. They released Castle in the Sky maybe 2 years beforehand, and they were still finding their feet, and most importantly, they had to engage with finances for every project. They didn't have the freedom that they would have a decade later to make whatever they wanted, e.g. with Spirited Away onwards. But this project came to them from the publishers of the novella, Shinchosa, who really wanted to get into the film business. So they approached Toshio Suzuki, who's the producer, the third part of that triumvirate of Studio Ghibli founders. And he saw an opportunity here. He's very shrewd business mind, and this is one of his great plays. Shinchosa wanted to make Grave of the Fireflies, and were going to put up the budget for that. And he saw an opportunity to use that as leverage with their other finances to get off the ground one of their unbacked projects, in this case, Hayao Miyazaki's My Neighbor Totoro, with the view to thinking that they'll be 2 short films aimed at children, shortish films, 80-odd minutes, and Grave of the Fireflies, because it's a war movie, there'll be a guaranteed audience of school kids going on school trips. And then at the same time, we'll have Hayao Miyazaki's film My Neighbor Totoro playing in a double bill, which is an amazing feat of negotiation there.
I mean, it sounds like as if over here we had got a double bill of Where the Wind Blows and The Snowman.
Exactly. So, they're both Raymond Briggs properties, right? So, this beautiful Christmas tale mixed with nuclear Holocaust tale. Exactly. So, that's what this is. Grave of the Fireflies, about firebombings at the end of the Second World War. My Neighbor Totoro, about young girls going on an adventure with a forest spirit. And on release, they were playing in double bills. There's some confusion over which film to play first. Do you want to be happy, then sad, then happy? And it didn't set the box office alight, even though reviews were strong. But over the years, both of these films have become linchpins of Ghibli's reputation.
It's really remarkable that they're coming out at the same time. Mm-hmm. And in my head and with my limited knowledge, both of these are within probably my top 5 most well-known Ghibli films. So the fact that this is a double bill that they're both working on them both concurrently is incredible.
And Grave of the Fireflies in particular, separate from My Neighbor Totoro, was eventually released in America in the mid-90s, and that was when people started noticing. And Roger Ebert, the great American critic in particular, watched that film and was a huge advocate, saying about how it's a film that is more than an animated film. It's not just a cartoon, it's a serious drama. Mm. So this was a film that really set that tone as Ghibli making more than just animated fantasy fare.
Yeah, this is not just a cartoon.
It's not. It's so much more, Jake. I'd love to know what you think about this. So I think let's just get cracking and move on to your review.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So the last Studio Ghibli film I'd seen before Grave of the Fireflies was Spirited Away, one of only two I'd seen at the time, the other being My Neighbor Totoro. Oh. So you can imagine how in my head Studio Ghibli was perhaps room for lighter fare, that it was quite...
Full of awe and wonder, yes, and lovely characters getting along, having, yes, adventures.
Yes, and then I hear this film about some fireflies that might die. and... I wasn't even prepared for that, let alone this sob story of two
harrowing
children.
Film, yes.
Yeah, trying to make it through the war in Japan, even from its opening line. After I've watched these two wonderful children's films, mm-hmm, and then I switch this one on, and I've got a poor kid dying of malnutrition in a train station, and the subtitle comes up saying that was the night I died. And you made me watch this.
This is the thing with this movie. It's certainly one of the greatest that Ghibli ever made, and Takahata in particular ever made. But it's one of the most depressing films.
Mm.
It really is an endurance test. You have to really preface this with, by the way, this is a serious, upsetting film.
Yeah. I can't imagine the dilemma in that when they were doing that double bill with Totoro.
Mm-hmm.
There's no easy place to put this film.
Even today, even, yeah, showing it today, because there is still the expectation that an animated film about two kids in war, we have completely different expectations, mm, of what that sort of movie is, right? We have a long tradition of Western films that have kids in war situations, but we wouldn't necessarily expect them to go through the ringer like this.
Yes. So in the earlier moments of this film, I was thinking of Steven Spielberg's work with that Innocence Amongst War, maybe, mm, less so his work on Saving Private Ryan. I'm thinking more of Empire of the Sun and War Horse as, mm-hmm, well, in which you would feel comfortable showing children it because the true horrors are perhaps never really explicitly seen.
Mm-hmm.
And in the first 15 minutes of this one, where there's the firebombings and you see trying to pack things up and get out of the city and save your sister, and it's all quite admirable, mm-hmm, and heroic, in which Sator is trying to save his sister, mm-hmm, and their possessions. And then there is a moment about, I think it's about 15 minutes into the film, in which we see the bandaged, mm, corpse of their mother, and blood dripping through the bandages and the dead eyes and mouth, and then eventually maggots crawling from the body. And for me, that was what made it flip to I'm realizing I'm in a different film here.
Well, that's what's incredible about this film in comparison to maybe Ghibli's other works, where characters are outsize, they're exaggerated, they're grotesque, but always delightful.
Mm.
And this film plays with realistic depictions of human characters in ways that the other films don't. And when you reach that moment where you can see maggots and flies on corpses, you actually see charred corpses being thrown into graves. It's stark and, mm, surprising and moving, and you know immediately what the stakes are.
Yeah, here. I think stark is a really interesting word to use for this film. And really wanted to talk about the art style. Although it may be recognisably coming from the same place as something like Spirited Away, I felt like there was some really bold decisions being made with how to represent the trauma of this event and the destruction of it. I'm coming from Spirited Away and I'm seeing quite busy screens just filled with colour and life and imagination and exuberance. And that's what is I find brilliant about that film. And this is almost the complete removal of that. Mm-hmm. There are some really stunning moments in which Saita and Setsuko are almost the only two moving things in the frame.
Yeah.
The backgrounds, the horizons, whatever they're standing on is almost washed out and disappearing. Mm. It's this complete focus on what is essential for telling the story.
Yeah.
And to me, there was this reading of the film focusing on war-torn places as becoming stuck in time, because I was looking at the landscapes and seeing where there's a bombed-out city or a house that's on fire, and the smoke isn't moving. Mm. It's just resting on the horizon. This tied into how the sound was designed for the film as well, and it's really focused in, it's localized, so we're just looking at or hearing the sound of feet trudging along through a muddy path, or the sound of feet as they try and escape, trying to steal something, or the effort that might go into eating something when you're suffering from malnutrition.
Well, the sound effects are something that stick with me for this film, amongst many other things. There's a part later in the film when they are at their lowest ebb, where they don't have food, where Setsuko is slowly dying from malnutrition, and Saita comes home, or to the shelter they're calling home, and sees her passed out on the floor with her trusty tin of fruit drops. And we know in the narrative that those fruit drops are long gone, but she's got them and she's got something in her mouth, and you hear this incredible like rattling noise of something passing between her teeth, and it's a marble that she's been sucking on, and in her fever she thinks it's a fruit drop, and it's so moving and sad, and just thinking about it is, you know, goose pimple inducing, really, isn't it? But whilst we're dwelling on the starkness of the film, there's a lot of poetry and magic.
Yeah, there really
is.
That was something that I really loved about it, actually, is that it descends into these magical moments that make it recognisably the studio that with my brief knowledge I can recognise, where something might just descend into metaphorical or symbolic realm for a moment, where we're just focusing on the lights of fireflies and their movements, and that's it. There is a link to these two characters being these two fireflies, but it's not essential for the narrative.
Not really, but it's such a beautiful image and a beautiful symbol, the fact that they burn so brightly and then die the next day, or they're suffocated by the moth netting that they're under. And used in the poster, in fact, the original poster is, you know, Saita and Setsuko with the fireflies, and the fireflies go all the way up this one sheet poster and turn into the firebombs that's being rained down above them. So this idea that this use of fire is something wonderful and magical, but also dangerous and life-changing, but also the frame device where you're guided through this story by the ghosts of these children in this red post kind of afterlife world where they're on a train and then keep popping up, and then you have flashbacks to their life before the war with their family, and then you see things before, after and during.
We are bouncing around on the way events unfold, but I think the film really plays fast and loose with that. It's not essential to really know when any of this is happening. Well, we said there's spoilers ahead. Well, there's spoilers in the first line of the film. You know going in what you're going to get at the end of it. And so it doesn't really matter where things happen. You just know you're in for a bad time. But what makes it really special is the moments of joy along the way.
Yeah,
I've already mentioned Raymond Briggs. And I was thinking of another film adapted from his work. And this was Ethel and Ernest, which came out a couple of years ago. And that's the story of a married couple in London from the early 20th century to their death in the late 20th century. And it goes through their romance and getting them together at the start, all the way through war to dementia and death. And it's punctuated with these absolute moments of humanity and wonder. And that's what makes this so harder to watch, is that when they do just have a really wonderful time, there's almost a Swiss Family Robinson feel.
Yeah.
When they leave the town, they get rid of the shackles of kind of family.
Oh, the busybody aunt who is always on their back about even wanting to eat.
Yeah, and they go and set up their own life, this brother and sister, and it's wonderful to watch.
There's something very exciting about that, isn't there?
You eventually see this, their cave that they've kind of turned into a home. You have the inevitable feeling that this is not going to work out.
Exactly.
And you have, and it, that eventually kind of leads us into this final 30 minutes. And from there on out, those moments of joy stop appearing as regularly.
Well, yes, it's also, there's this tension throughout about them wanting to just live their lives as children, this innocent, pure existence. But the world in its many forms, be that the world war, or be that the people, be that society, just stop them from doing it. There's a beautiful moment where I think they're playing piano, aren't they, and singing. And then the aunt goes by saying, "Don't you know there's a war going on?" And it's just the way that this context is trampling down childhood innocence. And then the final 30 minutes is just this inevitable slide where they have money in the bank, but it's a time of rationing, so they can't buy food. They're trying to barter and trade. Sater is pushed to lower depths of, in the end, he's ransacking houses that are abandoned during firebombing raids, putting himself in danger, leaving his sister back at the bomb shelter to try and steal, to then trade, to get whatever soybean paste or something to eat. And there's a turn there. There's something that reminds me almost of, not necessarily as grotesque as William Golding's Lord of the Flies, but it's something about, you see this photograph of the family that keeps coming back up, where they're all buttoned up, standing up straight, straight backed. The father is the Navy captain in the Imperial Navy. And in the end, what is the boy pushed to by circumstance? Stealing, lying, breaking tomatoes off branches in fields from farmers, running away from farmers. And that's what they're brought to. And then finally, death comes. It's one of the most upsetting and harrowing final acts in all the cinema, really. And it puts the film very much on a level playing field with these mid-80s feel-bad war movies. You mentioned Raymond Briggs earlier, When the Wind Blows, his film about this old couple in the UK when there's a nuclear attack and they're just slowly dying from radiation poisoning in their living room. Also Threads, which is a similar situation, a nuclear panic film about a bomb being dropped on Sheffield. And then the slow death and degradation of society there. And then this. And it's just, I think I mentioned before, this was referred to in a review as a three hanky film. And I don't think there are enough handkerchiefs in the world for the tears that this film provokes in people.
Yeah, and there's a really wonderful moment where we figure out that the abandoned bomb shelter that they've been staying in is actually in the grounds of this mansion. And the residents of the mansion after Japan have surrendered return to the mansion and put on a record called Home Sweet Home. And the camera whatever you want to, the frame moves from the mansion kind of over the valley down to the bomb shelter, and you have this ghost of the little girl just moving amongst the cave and playing with the water and playing with dragonflies. And this is just heartbreaking. And that's when it got to me. And when someone tells you that a film is going to make you cry, that's a kind of warning to me that it's probably not going to. The thing that makes me cry is when I'm not expecting to. And that's what will set me off. Whereas if I'm prepared for it, it's not going to happen. And this one, I was prepared for it, and it still made it happen.
Yeah.
So I think it just goes to show how powerful that was.
It's powerful, but also it's worth mentioning that there are so many subtle complexities to the storytelling here. You mention this family that come back and put on the record. There's such an irony there. They're living in this Western-style mansion outside of Kobe. Their life has not been touched by these firebombings. They've been evacuated anyway. And it's these young girls wearing Western-style flowing dresses coming in. It's like, we're back home. Like, they've been on holiday. When there are there's this real toil that's been... this innocence that they'll never get back. Yeah. And the final shot of the film, which some people, I guess, is easy to remember because by that point your eyes have probably misted over completely. Yeah. But the final shot is the two ghosts of the kids on the sort of hill by the train station and the fireflies coming up next to them. The camera pans up and it shows modern day Japan, saying this is what you had to reckon with. This is the innocence we lost at this point 4 decades before. We need to remember this. We can't forget. And I think this is undoubtedly one of Ghibli's masterpieces. Not one I revisit very often. Would you revisit this, Jake?
I actually want to revisit it quite soon, which is weird. But it was just to kind of reconcile with an issue that I had with the film and that I found it actually quite hard to follow. Just the state of who is related to who at what time and the money situation. It doesn't establish the relationships between people beyond the brother and sister.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I found it quite hard. I didn't actually fully get that the person in the first scene was Saita.
Okay.
And so I would like to just go back to it just to clear everything up for me. Yeah. Arguably, that is an issue with the film that perhaps an audience should be able to understand it. But I think it's also part of Ghibli's storytelling is that it's not completely locked into a narrative structure like that. And I'm not going to go out and say that like this is a bad thing with the film. I'm sure second time round, I'll know what's going on, and I would be happy to say this is a masterpiece already.
Yeah, but it had
an
impact.
It so affecting. Yeah,
yeah.
So we've just confirmed that we both think this is a masterpiece,
yes.
And now it's time to put it on our ranking system, the leaderboard.
Okay, so far on the leaderboard, we only have one film, which is Spirited Away.
It's been in first place for a while.
It's been in first place. This is a hard one. So I think that Spirited Away is a slightly flawed masterpiece, but maybe not the masterpiece. Mm. And I think Grave of the Fireflies is an absolute masterwork, but not one I want to watch every day of the week. So this is one of those cases where you say, do you love a film because you can rewatch it any day of the week, or do you love a film because it is a great piece of cinema?
Mm.
And I think on this one, I'm going to place Grave of the Fireflies ahead of Spirited Away.
Okay.
So let's put that in first place.
Right, wow.
That's now the gold standard, the one to beat.
Okay, and so that means next time we're going to have to see where My Neighbor Totoro fares.
Yes, so next episode we're going to finish that fabled double bill. We've watched the sad one, and now we can watch the joyous one.
Yeah, yeah. It'll be the third one that I've seen.
Perfect.
Then we're at all of them. all of the ones
Uncharted
that I've actually
Uncharted territory after that.
Yeah, who knows what to expect beyond that one. Right. We hope you've enjoyed your time in the Ghibliotech. As we said, next time it's My Neighbor Totoro. Until then, you can follow Michael on Twitter at Michael J. Leader.
And you can follow Jake on Twitter at Jake H. Cunningham.
And if you're enjoying the show, we'd really appreciate it if you subscribed on iTunes and Acast. You can review us on there as well, give us a star rating and a comment as well. We'd really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. We record at Soho Radio, our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Steph Watts helps us out with all of our GIFs, images, and anything else we post online. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, and Harold Scheel. That's me. I do the voiceover for the credits as well.
Hi everyone, thanks again for sticking around after the credits. We like to reward our listeners with a little bit of trivia. For Grave of the Fireflies, we did mention the fruit drops that pop up throughout the film. They're actually a brand in Japan called Sakuma Fruit Drops, and the company decided after the success of the film to reissue these fruit drops with packaging, a special tin packaging that reflects the design in the film. And they're actually still available from your various online retailers of choice. So if you want to get something sweet out of this very sour experience of watching Grave of the Fireflies, you can go and pick them up.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.